Hi, everyone. Welcome to the FloridaProgressives.com podcast, episode 5 for May 23rd, 2014. I'm Mike Itzen. This show delivers news and updates via interviews with activists around the state on the issues that you, the people of Florida, care about. This episode is about immigration, and later in the show, the ways that progressives can collaborate through the use of Facebook. As usual, listeners, stick around for the end of the show to hear the list of actions, groups, and resources discussed on the show that can help you affect positive change. Edwin Enciso specializes in grassroots movement building. In 2010, as Florida Director of Democracia, he coordinated engagement of 2,000 Latino small business owners on a clean energy support pledge, around 10,000 undocumented workers on census participation, 52,000-plus Latinos on voter registration, and tens of thousands of Latinos on voting itself. After the 2010 elections, he helped coordinate conferences to draw community organizers from throughout the state to organize legislative engagement and to set policy priorities. In 2011 and 2012, he served as the state community organizer for the Florida AFL-CIO, where he helped develop and support 10 county-level community organizer networks in the model of the state network to share concerns, to identify opportunities to collaborate. After leaving that role, his focus has been on national comprehensive immigration reform. He serves as the coordinator for the CIR Now campaign, which supports organizing of several district teams working on reform. Edwin, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Mike. Really appreciate being on the show.
Let's start with the way that the Republican stance on immigration has changed, because if you recall, it was roughly 4 years ago where the Papers, Please legislation out of Arizona, that was what was driving the conversation. They believed that, you know, the federal government wasn't acting enough on immigration, so Arizona had to take things in their own hands. And it was the rest of the country, or at least from where I was sitting, it seemed like it was a negative reaction to what Arizona and Alabama did. But I remember Governor Rick Scott, right when he became governor, he was endorsing the Papers, Please idea. Nowadays, in this year, he is supporting the Florida tuition bill to try to get undocumented immigrants, people that are not documented, they are able to go to college, people that came here through no fault of their own. So throughout 4 years, the stance of the Republican Party has changed a lot. What do you think about that turn with Republicans? And are you finding any common ground with Republicans lately through your work?
Thank you. Really great question. The challenge with how the landscape of immigration reform has changed has really come about because of not only the movement that the immigrant rights community has developed nationally, but also because of the political engagement of our community over the course of the last presidential cycles especially, but over years. So we've gone from a smaller percentage of the voting population to now 10%. And also something that's changed is how we vote. I'll get specific.
Sure.
Back in 2004, here in Florida, the Latino population voted only 41% for candidate Kerry, and the rest voted for his opponent. And so that's a particular stance on politics here in Florida. By 2008, that had shifted over to where 57% voted for candidate Obama, and the rest had voted for his opponent. And in 2012, that trend strengthened nationally. So the pressure that that created is what really got the change from 2010 to 2012 established. In 2010, Latinos didn't go out to vote in very strong numbers, especially as compared to 2008. In Florida, we had an especially disastrous year because even though Rick Scott started his campaign blog by saying, "I support Arizona 1070,"
yes,
Latinos ended up voting for him by 51% here in Florida.
Oh.
So that shift and similar trends throughout the country were disastrous for us, and that was the year of Arizona bills. It's an important lesson to be drawn, because what happened before that is there was an immigration reform effort in 2009 and 2010 that isn't very well known, but the biggest effort centered around the DREAM Act. There was an effort to pass comprehensive immigration reform.
Yes,
but that only
I remember
received,
that one, yes.
Yes, 104 co-sponsorships. So what ended up happening after that is that the as a result of the frustration and the thought that there wasn't going to be comprehensive immigration reform, there was a push by the youth movement for the Dream Act, and they succeeded beyond, I think, many people's expectations, certainly mine, in obtaining 54 co-sponsorships in the Senate for the Dream Act. Mm-hmm. The trouble is, after the failure of the Dream Act, we didn't really hold the people who voted against it or for it into account. So, for example, here in Florida, there was widespread condemnation of both parties, although one party voted for the Dream Act by 90% and the other party voted against it by 90%.
Yes, people can look at the system itself and get cynical at everybody instead of actually think about who was responsible. I mean, 54 votes in the Senate, most people would consider that a majority, but because of the way the Senate works, it failed in late 2010, like you said.
That's exactly right. The trouble is, here in Florida, in 2011, there were several White House symposiums on Latinos and education. And one of the things that I did to help illustrate the problem that we had with holding people accountable and then supporting the people who were friendly to us in the room, I'd ask everyone in a polite way so as not to offend people directly, but I would say, look, go to whoever you respect the most when it comes to Latino politics. Mm-hmm. And now consider that at these White House meetings, really, the people gathered were among the most politically astute people we have in the community. The leaders of the Latino community, and I'd ask that person, who were the co-sponsors in Florida for the leading comprehensive immigration reform bill? We had five. Really, what I was saying is, do you know who the co-sponsors were in Florida? And then what I told them is, and consider that if people don't respond, if they don't tell you, that means that they weren't a part of trying to obtain those co-sponsorships.
Yes.
And I said, worse, for our cause, we lost supporters in 2010 because we didn't know who were the people in Congress who were supporting us. We didn't support them, and we lost them. The consequences of this are disastrous for the community. We not only aren't participating and leveraging democracy, but literally what the signal that we're sending out into the political mainstream is that if you stand with us, we won't stand with you.
Yeah.
Which is the very worst thing that you can do in politics, because politics is a sort of agreement among everyone that we won't use physical violence to settle our differences. We'll use the political system to settle our differences. But it is just as tenacious as outright open conflict. And people expect that if you're going to be an ally within this environment, people stick their neck out for you, and you don't, you're not willing to fight for yourself. I mean, you put yourself and your cause in a lot of trouble. So that's where we were in 2010.
Yep. And I think it's a trend with not just the Latino community, but all communities. What happened with, obviously, the Tea Party movement taking hold starting with the year 2011, electorally, I would think there would be a lot of regrets now that they didn't do more when they had a better opportunity. So now it's about kind of restabilizing and building it back again. But who knows how long that's going to take because of the way that Congress works. It may take a while. I just hope people don't give up, you know?
Well, this is where a lot of my work centers, mm-hmm. within not only the immigrant rights movement, but the progressive movement. And it is centered around helping to build political acumen. There's a duty that the Constitution puts on us in Article 1, Section 1, which describes legislative powers. When it says that all of those powers are in the Congress, what it means is, one, that as a citizen of the Republic or even a resident of this nation, if there is an unjust law, you have a duty to demand that Congress change it. Mm-hmm. Now, if Congress fails to do that, then you have a second duty, which is to take note of the people who were supportive of reform, of just change, and to stand with them. And then two, for those people who oppose just reform, you have a duty to remove them and replace them with people who are willing to change things. And if you're not paying attention, if your movement isn't guided by that principle, then you undermine democracy, because I will tell you that the people who are advancing, then you're basically abdicating that space to the people who do. And that's a huge problem, as you said, not just with the immigrant rights movement and with all movements. I mean, and we have a lot to learn from the Obama campaign. They were very successful in drawing minority communities out. And that really made a huge difference, because when we didn't show up in 2010, we ended up disrespected. We had to deal with all of these terrible Arizona-style laws that popped up throughout the nation. But when we participated in 2012, the reverse happened. Not only did the brakes get put on that agenda, but we started to move things in the opposite direction toward reform. And we succeeded within 6 months after the election of passing the most comprehensive immigration reform bill that we've had in decades through the Senate. And a year later, we were successful in going from that 104 co-sponsors back in 2010 to now having 200 co-sponsors for the leading immigration reform effort, which is H.R. 15.
Mm-hmm. And that's in the House of Representatives, right?
That's in the House of Representatives, right, exactly.
When Ray Seaman was on the show in episode two, he and I spoke briefly about how Rick Scott slashed education down big time. You know, not just him, obviously, but the legislature. And then now this year, because it's an election year, they're restoring education funding slightly. I would say the same thing is happening with immigration issues. You know, the Florida tuition bill, great news, right? Are you happy to hear about the Florida tuition bill this year? Because it sounds like
– Of course.
Yeah. But then is it going to fool voters into thinking that, you know, like, is the trick going to work? Or are they going to remember the full four-year term of Rick Scott?
Well, this is why – electoral engagement is so important because you really need to – it's sort of like fighting. You know, if you don't practice boxing and you just jump into a ring, or you end up in a fight and you've never exercised in that way, you're at a serious disadvantage. The reality of American politics is that people get ready for this. They know that power is going to be granted to decision makers, and they invest in training and prepping for that fight. And our opposition is very effective, very effective. So the trouble with what our opposition is doing right now throughout many legislatures, where they're helping a lot of immigrant community advocates pass these sorts of bills, even though not even 4 years ago, they were pushing the extreme opposite. In my opinion, has very little to do with actual care for our community. Because if they wanted to support our community, they could publicly advocate comprehensive immigration reform with the pathway to citizenship.
Yes.
The real politic, and by real politic, I mean the...
Kind of the behind-the-scenes stuff that really...
The behind-the-scenes, exactly. Yeah. The sort of hard analysis of what's happening is the opposition has... The political position where they've agreed already on the DREAM Act at the national level. They've agreed on granting all sorts of rights shy of citizenship. So this effort to basically push through the federal version of their reform program is not a great concession on their part. This is what they've already agreed to do as a result of the federal fight that we've been in since 2013. That's not to say that we shouldn't be very happy and proud of our movement for securing what they can for our students, and in some cases, driver's licenses for others and other benefits and rights. The thing is that we have to be politically astute and understand that they're not really giving us more. In fact, in most cases, they're giving us much less than what the national fight has already agreed on. And so we still, during the cycle, need to make sure that we hold them accountable. Like, if you really care about immigrant communities, then agree to support a resolution through the state. And there was one in Florida, so they have an opportunity to explain why they did or did not support that. But explain why you did or did not support a resolution in support of federal comprehensive immigration reform, like many other states have passed. And it's the same in Congress. Why wouldn't you co-sponsor H.R. 15? And if you haven't co-sponsored H.R. 15, then you're the reason why reform hasn't passed. And we need to hold them accountable. And that's the missing element of not only the immigration rights movement, But as we mentioned before, this is one of the chief challenges of a lot of movements. That's why this work is so important. And the congressional district fight in the special election of District 13 really is a warning to us all, because the results of that election were very scary from our perspective.
This was David Jolly versus Alex Sink, right?
That's exactly right. And Lucas Overby, the libertarian,
yes,
who was also a supporter of comprehensive immigration reform. But when you look at the numbers, the returns, you see that there's always a drop during the non-presidential years. Mm-hmm. So if you take a look at the highest performing turnout in 2012, you had 74% of the white vote turned out, 72% of the black vote, 64% of the Latino vote, and 64% of what the supervisors of elections call other. When you go to 2010, there's a drop down to 54% for the white vote, 42% for the black vote, 32% for the Latino vote, and 31% for other. But in this special election, at a time when Latinos should have been focused nationally, not just in the state or at that county, mm-hmm, but nationally on leveraging this as an example to the country of what is going to happen to Latinos. I mean, to anyone who says that they're going to keep this new Jim Crow system over our communities. Instead, what happened is the reverse. So 42% of the white vote came out. There was a radical drop down to 24% of the black vote. There was also a drop, but not as bad for the other category. But then, worst of all, the worst performing group was 19.7, which was the Latino community. And that's disastrous for us, mm-hmm, because the signal that we send is you can hurt our families. We can plead with you to stop. And like a crazy bully, you've told us that you're not going to. And what do? We undervote.
Yeah.
So we've got to turn this around. And that's part of what we're doing with the CIR Now campaign. This is a grassroots campaign. It's extraordinary in its accomplishments as a grassroots campaign. And one of the things that the delegates from all the different district teams did by agreement on our statewide conference call was to denounce the present strategy, which is to focus on the White House, focus on an executive order, and to state that this is a red herring, that so many of the leaders that are pushing the movement in that direction are mistaken about the extent of executive discretion that exists, mm-hmm, and especially the idea that the president, the executive branch of government, is to blame for 2 million deportations is not only wrong, it's a lie.
Oh, okay, because I had read that, you know, there is a level of discretion with the executive branch in terms of how many deportations they choose to do. From what I read, Obama was even higher than Bush at one point.
So that's I'm really glad that we have a chance to talk, because mm-hmm, that's a problem that exists within the political consciousness nationally. And we have a position paper on the CIR Now website that really goes into this in detail. But I'll give you the overview of some of the
okay,
problems that exist.
And I'll link to the report at the end of the show, too.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
I appreciate that, Mike. But the title of the report, if you go to the CIR Now Facebook page, which is facebook.com/CIRNow, there's a navigation bar below the banner, and one of the options is notes. And the top note says, "Not one more deportation.com by executive order is wrong." And basically, one of the things that we alert the movement to are the judicial statements that have been made regarding executive discretion. So we don't want you to take our opinion for it. We want you to take a look at what judges have said about this.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look, there was recently a suit by the unions that represent the Border Patrol and ICE agents against Napolitano, which was responsible for immigration enforcement. And within that ruling, what the judge says is, in its previous order, the court found that Congress' use of the word shall in section 125B2A of the Immigration and Nationality Act imposes a mandatory obligation on immigration officers to initiate removal proceedings against aliens they encounter who are not, quote, clearly and beyond a doubt entitled to be admitted. What the judge, and he quotes like the law here, and then he goes on to say, see also the application of USA for historical cell site data, and he quotes the case, finding that the word shall of the Stored Communications Act imposes a mandatory duty on courts to issue an order for disclosure when certain prerequisites are satisfied. Therefore, the court concluded that plaintiffs were likely to succeed on the merits of their claim and that the Department of Homeland Security has implemented a program contrary to a congressional mandate. This is a judge talking about the deferred action program of the president to help protect Dreamers from deportation. Mm-hmm. And what the judge has specifically said is that this program is running contrary to the congressional mandate. The only reason why this suit did not succeed, according to this judge, is because Congress took away the right of these unions to sue. But if they had had this right, what this judge has said is that he thinks that they would have prevailed. In other words, he would have declared that that executive order was unconstitutional.
Right. So
The limits of executive discretion.
Exactly. That's what I was about to say.
It's not a dictatorship.
Yes. Okay. Final question on immigration is, when you encounter people that are hurt by these policies and, you know, their families are being broken apart and or they're denied proper employment or they're denied access to college, what do you think is the biggest misconception about who they are when it comes to the American electorate overall?
I think that the biggest misconception is how much the nation benefits from. I mean, a lot of people talk about how much the undocumented population pays in taxes, how basically they've been paying for Social Security and helping make sure that the program remains solvent. But even larger than that contribution, there was a study in 2008 by the Perryman Group that was a study of the 9 million population at that time. And what they found is that in extended revenues, so not only what these undocumented workers produce, but as you know, things that are produced then go into the warehousing cycle. So there's that cycle. Then there's the distribution cycle. There's the retail cycle. There's an aftermarket. There's related industries to all of these, from software to trucking to electricity. I mean, there's all sorts of industries that help manage what is produced by this undocumented population. So in extended revenues, we benefit to the tune of $550 billion from this population of at that time, 9 million. So it's even much more now. And this was confirmed by a more recent California study of what amounts to half of the total undocumented population in California. Mm-hmm. So when you double that out, you get confirmation of this. So what people don't understand is that there are people profiting very, very greatly from this. And the punishment against the white, mostly white, I should say, corporate owners is a slap in the hand. For them, a cost of doing business.
Oh,
but
like,
for these
like
populations.
You mean if they employ undocumented workers?
Exactly.
Okay.
And against this population, it's the extreme separation of families and the destruction of everything that they've been working for. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of these families are then left destitute. And what's sick about this new indentured servitude is that once upon a time, at least Americans felt shame when they knew that there were corporations and people within our nation that were exploiting foreigners, mm-hmm. taking advantage of them. And we were so outraged that we made it illegal to allow people to sell themselves into bondage. But now we've reached a point of what I would say ethical degeneration as a result of this radical right agenda, where we blame the indentured servants for our system of indentured servitude, the one that we as a nation benefit from to the tune of billions.
Yeah.
And so that's the problem. It's almost as if as a nation, there's a sickness in our politics where we are blaming slaves for a system of slavery.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so let's switch gears entirely, and talk about some of the work that you've been doing online. I kind of specifically wanted to ask you about Facebook and the use of conference calls. A lot of people just think about Facebook. They think about how it's a way to hang out and catch up with old friends and stuff. But how can you use a social media platform like Facebook and conference calls to kind of go over what is called best practices? Like, so you don't waste time doing ineffective work, but in other words, you do the best method to try to get some real political change happening.
Well, I really appreciate the question. I think one of the important things to do is to talk about the problem that you have between meetings. So one, especially over a geography like Florida, it's incredibly difficult to meet in person. So you need conference calls. But then during your conference call, it's really hard to share information and then to make sure that you're organizing information between conference calls and doing work. I actually, before I entered nonprofit management, I worked at a bank, and I worked in the small division of a very large bank. And we had access to an intranet, which let us not only organize information, it let us set appointments, a lot of great functionality that you need to work as teams across national spaces. Well, we as grassroots organizers, we compete. And many times against organizations that have access to these tools that help multiply their people power. So we can't afford to pass up, especially free technology. And technology, makes a huge difference. In our ancient Mesoamerican history, the advantage of technology that the conquistadors had in weapons and so many other things allowed a small group to have a massive influence on our history. And the same thing happens, in today's environment. So the importance of Facebook is that it gives you one of the most incredible tool sets for free, tools that 10 years ago you'd had to pay a paid staff, very expensive, IT professionals, you'd have to pay tens of thousands in technology infrastructure. Now it's available for free. You can not only organize events, you can have private group communication, and you can also set up your own private wikis, which is a document that can be edited by all the members of your group. You can then take what you do in the group and share it publicly via a different platform called a Facebook page. And when you use both in conjunction with the telephone conference service, you can get a lot of work done.
I think it's called freeconferencecalls.com. Isn't that the one that you guys usually use?
The one that we use is freeconferencecalling.com.
Oh,
We
there we go.
don't get any money from them, but we're very grateful for their service. It also allows you to boot people off the call. You can mute the whole call, you can record it, and those services are also free. So I strongly encourage organizers to leverage that. In terms of the CIR Now campaign, this campaign that has helped in district organizers put together over 200 events across 14 congressional districts. Without these tools, we wouldn't have been able to support one another, organize information, and organize activity the way we have, if not for this. Also, don't get money from Facebook, but really glad to share best practices.
All right. Well, Edwin, thanks so much for all the organizing that you do on behalf of Florida, and thanks for joining me today.
Great program. Glad to have been a part of it. Thanks, Mike.
And now for resources and calls to action. The Coalition for Comprehensive Immigration Reform is at cirnow.org, and you can find more information about CIR Now at facebook.com/CIRnow. Edwin Enciso is on Facebook at Edwin period Enciso. You can read up on some of the topics discussed on the show via links on floridaprogressives.com, including the DREAM Act attempt in 2009 and 2010 and what it would have done, the exact vote count in the Senate for that, a summary of the election results from this year's Congressional District 13 race, an article from the Miami Herald about the Hispanic voting population in Florida through the lens of the current race for governor. You can use the free conference call service at freeconferencecalling.com. That's with an ING at the end. And there are other similar services out there for free that are a great tool for any organizer to use. Some of the document sharing through Facebook wikis and functionality like that Edwin spoke of is used by the Florida Progressives Collective on Facebook. Despite similar names, the FloridaProgressives.com podcast has no affiliation with this group, but I am in solidarity with the goals of the collective. Check them out on the Florida Progressives page at facebook.com/FLPros. Edwin cited a report to support the claim that deportations are out of the executive branch's hands. My point wasn't about one judge's ruling on deferred action, it was the entire presidency, including before that executive order. There are a lot of articles, if you do a Bush-Obama deportations search, describing how the executive branch determines how much to enforce the deportation policy. I included two articles, one from Mother Jones and one from The Nation, in the links section. So having responded to that, Edwin, if you want to respond to this, I'll print your comments in one of these closing segments and let you have the final word, unless you felt you said all you wanted on the subject. Okay, back to resources. Another report Edwin cited was by the Perryman Group in 2008. The report in PDF form is linked to on the website. FloridaProgressives.com is the home to this podcast. It started 1 month ago, and to promote the first month, I have a 7-minute-long show featuring clips from the first 5 episodes and some of the key points my guests made. Check it out. Episode 6 will be out Wednesday, May 28th. This music is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com and is licensed under the Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Look for the Facebook fan page by searching for the FloridaProgressives.com podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Mike Idson, last name spelled E-I-D-S-O-N, and you can also send me an email, michael.c.idson@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.